Hello, boys and girls. This is Daisy. Wait, you might think that I took a lot of... I went to Eastern Europe, took a lot of steroids, and came back. No, this is Alex, and Daisy is off for the week, and I am in stepping in. It's almost uncomfortable. I'm not used to hosting my own show anymore, so I feel like I'm gonna have to be running the board. This might be a little rocky. I'm running the board and asking all the questions. Leo is much better at this than I am. But also here in the studio, we've got David Rewall.
Hello, hello, everybody.
Hey, David, how you doing?
I'm great.
And on the Skype, on the internets, people hate it when we say that, but I'm going to say it anyway. We've got Tim Street. Hey, Tim.
Hello, hello.
And also Hayden Black from Goodnight Burbank. Hey, Hayden.
Hey, good to be here.
Good to have you here. So we've got a lot on the pipe here. David, what's our first big story?
First big story, we're going to talk about the IMAX theater and the fake IMAX.
The LIMAX.
The LIMAX.
The LIMAX. give us a breakdown of what's happening here.
So essentially, IMAX is promoting the fact that they've got all these theaters that are showing movies in IMAX, but you go there and most of them on a regular size screen. You don't get that big 72-foot screen that, you know, you're anticipating IMAX to be. And I got duped when I went and saw Watchmen over in Emeryville, thinking, oh my God, this is going to be like the Metreon, the big 70-foot screen. And it was just a normal theater, and you pay $5 more for nothing, essentially.
Yeah, so now Tim, have you been, or Tim or Hayden, have you been caught with this in the past?
Yeah, I haven't had the misfortune of going to one of the smaller screens, but I mean, does this really just boil down to size matters?
That's one of the questions. Is one of the things about it, is that the only thing that makes an IMAX screen an IMAX screen? So, for instance, when something's a THX screen, that has a lot to do with the sound. It has a lot to do with the certain size of the screen, with the brightness of the screen. You know, that registration for THX means something. But I'm not sure how that interrelates with. David, do you know what the IMAX label means?
I don't, honestly. And that's kind of one of the things I think that was annoying to me going, when I saw Watchmen, was I couldn't distinguish that experience from just paying the normal price and seeing it in the other theater across the hall as to what the actual experiential difference was.
Right.
You know, to me, it was the size of the screen was the only thing, as the layman's that I consider IMAX to be.
Right, and I know I haven't seen one of these infamous screens yet. Now these are the digital ones, so these are the digital projections. I think that what they're really focusing on here, and I don't think that they're actually doing a digital projection the size of what we would consider. I think part of the reason of having a smaller screen is that the size of the file, the size of the screens, the projection is going to be smaller because it's they're not doing a full resolution IMAX projection, because there's not a lot of cameras that shoot that in digital, or even if you scanned it, playing that back is not trivial. Remember when we double the size of the image, we're quadrupling the bandwidth, we're quadrupling the size of the file, we're quadrupling all those other things. And so I think that's probably one of the challenges that they're dealing with going in here. I have to admit, I go into to IMAX. I watch as many shows as I can in IMAX because of the quality, but the one that I go to is the Metreon, which is actually pretty good. Except,
really good.
We were talking about this a little earlier. I actually went to the Metreon and saw IMAX films for free for about a year because the IMAX in the Metreon. They're going to hate that I said this on the show. The IMAX on the Metreon, the audio is off by for a long time. I don't know if it still is because I don't live down there, but it was off by about 2 to 3 frames. And at first I thought that I was having a drug problem without taking the actual drugs. And then I realized that it really was off. And then I thought maybe it was off at the beginning. And then I realized it was really off the whole way through. So I came out and I said, your sync's off. It's off. And he just, the manager didn't even ask me. He just handed me passes for the next film. And so I went to the next one and thinking, well, that, you know, some projectionist made a mistake. And I came back and said, you know, and sync was still off. And I came back out and said, your sync's off, you know, and he handed me two more tickets. And I realized at that point that it was easier to give me two tickets than to fix it. And so I got into this habit of every time there was a new big film out, I'd go to see the IMAX. I learned that after about 10 or 15 minutes, it didn't give me a, you know, didn't upset me once I knew that I was expecting it to be just a little bit off, you know, and I think that the average person might go up there and not notice. It's just that I've had to do a lot of audio syncing. So I was having trouble with it. And then I actually went to see, I went to see it in the regular theater to make sure that it wasn't just the, because a lot of times things will look out of sync. We're getting a little techier than we normally get, but things will look out of sync because they're doing ADR, automatic dialogue replacement. So there are a lot of movies, someone's actually speaking over top of what they said in the scene. And so when they're in the middle of this ADR, it will look like it's a little off, but it was like all the way through the movie with all the sound effects and everything else. And so anyway, so I got, I got to see probably six or eight movies nice. For free. As far as I know, it's still there. When you go to the Metreon, I probably once again have ruined people's viewing experience because they probably didn't notice before. You mostly notice it in dialogue. You don't notice it in everything else, but when you see dialogue, you'll see their mouth, and it just what it feels like when something. For those of you, we have some people in the forum saying, you know, how could you tell if it's two frames off? What it will feel like when you know what syncing looks like. When something's off sync, it will feel like it's underwater. And that's the best way I can describe it. It just feels like their mouth isn't quite, there's this heaviness to it that you can feel. And when it's in sync, it feels very sharp. Mm-hmm. You know, like when their mouth is moving exactly at the right, you know, it's hard to describe other than a feeling.
That happens on my Apple TV all the time. Like I have to restart a movie or a TV show because the audio will just be a slight bit out. And it takes me a while to figure out, is it off? Is it
right?
And then I'll restart it, and I'm like, yeah, it was.
Yeah, and so, if you do a couple days of resyncing stuff, you'll get real good at knowing that it's off. So anyway,
you know, this really seems like a case of brand permission. You know, IMAX does not have brand permission to do iMini or iMedium. They need to do the IMAX experience. I mean, that's the brand that they've created, and that's what everybody's expecting.
Yeah. No, I think that's definitely their problem. Is that's the whole basis of it. And there are technical limitations. You know, that's the issue. Is that there's technical limitations to making that actually work. Those are really, really big screens. But it is important. I think that what they're missing here is they do have to do something. It was suggested in the article that talks about this. It's clear that it was suggested that they make a distinction.
Mm-hmm.
That they distinct that this is IMAX. I believe IMAX Digital, or something that lets people know when they look at the theater that this is a different kind of screen. It's not the big screen that you're used to. And because, like, we know that, for instance, the difference between IMAX and OmniMax. And OmniMax is that big curved viewing mm-hmm. area, which is actually not that good for watching big films because it's a little too wrapped around. But the IMAX is it has a certain look that we expect. And I think that the problem that they're having is the problem that they have is that they have it as called as IMAX, but the problem that they need to look at is being able to let us distinguish, you know, what we're buying. You know, I bet you it's still a better experience than a regular screen because you probably have a lot of sound and a lot of other things that make it a lot. For me, sound is a big part of why I go to IMAX, is because it's this great big sound, and they don't worry so much about people calling and saying the sound was too loud.
And I think though that the problem is just that they've branded IMAX for years as the big screen,
right?
And, you know, even in the article, they're saying, well, we don't think of it as a big screen, but more of just an immersion experience overall. But I think the average, you know, consumer just thinks IMAX is a huge screen.
Right.
And, you know, paying $5 extra and having, you know, not very good clarity on what the difference is as to what the other theater across the hall has is tough.
We're going from IMAX to WiMAX. But before that, we're going to thank our sponsor, Squarespace.com, which is a fast and easy way to publish a high quality website or blog. Now, this is the thing that we're moving. Some of the TWIM stuff, we've already moved twiplog.com to Squarespace, and we're looking at moving just about every website that we're delivering right now to Squarespace within the Pixel Core, and we're very, very excited about it. It is what's great, of course, is that if you're an expert, you can, you know, inject a lot of code, you can do all the expert CSS stuff that you need to do, but if you are a beginner, you have a WYSIWYG way to sort that out. So, you know, everything's built in, whether you want to do blogs, forums, photo galleries, form builders, Google Maps, all of that stuff is built in. You've got tracking, you've got all the pieces that you need. And the best part about it is that the people who are creating the content, if you're creating the content, you're actually editing the look of the site. What you're not doing is having to send it out to some coder who's going to put that stuff out. And try to get it fixed for you, and then keep going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. So, so it's something that we're you know, we're very excited about, and we hope that people will check it out, because we've been using it a lot. We have a ton of people within the Pixel Core working with it. If you're interested in checking it out, you can get a free trial at squarespace.com/twim. That is, and there's no credit card needed. There's nothing. It's just a free setup. And you can get 10% off when you order. If, once again, you go to squarespace.com/twim, when you order, you want to use TWIM as your coupon code. So check it out, squarespace.com/twim. That's it. And now we're off to WiMAX. David.
Lots of Maxes today. So Cisco and Clearwire are teaming up to provide WiMAX in 20 square mile radiuses in cities, starting Baltimore and Portland, and then they're working on the Bay Area, I think, next. My question, what was interesting to me about this article is we've heard about WiMAX for years and years. It's coming, you know, the whole city's going to be lit up and all that. But this looks like the first sort of official move to actually see some traction and some effort there. I'm curious, though, with Cisco building, you know, WiMAX devices for small office and everything, how does this change, you know, the nature of, you know, Wi-Fi connectivity? How does it affect the Comcasts of the world and the AT&Ts of the world and all of that?
Well, I think that something has to happen, because right now we're still stuck with a wire, mm-hmm. you know, which is, you know, I know that I am in the middle of that right now, because I'm trying to figure out, you know, I have a very long distance between my office and where the cable comes in, and I'm still stuck with trying to extend a Wi-Fi, or, you know, and it's just something that I should be able to subscribe to and let my computers, you know, access. Mm-hmm. Now, Tim, do you think that there's any legs to WiMAX?
Well, it's going to be interesting to see what the business model is for this, because, you know, a lot of people are talking about WiMAX being free and making it available in public areas. What's that going to do to other people? I mean, you know, when it comes down to lobbying and the different lobby organizations, they usually are pretty good at keeping what the people really want away from them.
that's the key to the operation, isn't it?
I mean, like, you try to take a train from downtown LA to LAX, you can't do it. You get at the airport at Oakland, you have to get on a bus to go to the bar. You know, there's a reason that they didn't build those all the way to the airports. So,
well, now, to be fair, you know, San Francisco actually has.
It's great. San Francisco is great.
It's awesome.
That's a weird city. You know?
I know.
We're living in a bubble.
Yeah. And that is the case. I mean, there's oftentimes one of the things you always have is this big push back and forth with the people who have already put billions, to be fair, mm-hmm. billions of dollars of investment into running hard lines. And they want to, you know, recoup that investment before the city comes in. But I do think that there is a stimulus, when we talk about stimulus bills, there's a stimulus opportunity for many municipalities by providing everybody. And I think there's a lot of businesses that could be created by making sure that everybody at least has basic access. I don't think it means that we have to give everybody, you know, 16 megabits up and down. You know, I think
it's great for your kind of local flasher who can now just take a computer with him to a coffee shop and watch porn in peace and not have to bother anybody.
You know, I I never thought of that. I never occurred to me.
That's why they pay me the big bucks, my friend.
Yes, exactly. So anyway, yeah, it'll be interesting to see, you know, how that that goes off, and it may be connected to even our next story, which is you know, how the Kindle lets you steal blogs. So David, can you give us a little bit of
So essentially, you know, Amazon's new blog publishing program allowed people, at first round of this, allowed people to publish or republish, call it anyone's blog, and get paid on it. So I could take Alex's blog, publish it, and get paid for that.
Right.
So it was sort of this...
A little bit of technical error. Well, and I think that this is one of the reasons when a lot of people ask why Apple creates kind of this pipeline that people have to get through to get onto the iPhone. This is a good example of what happens when you let that door open. So is this a new problem or an older problem?
I think this is pretty recent.
Right.
You know, Amazon, you know, since sent a fix out, but you know, like TechCrunch was the first one that got sort of
so basically ripped off. Someone else was charging $199 for TechCrunch.
Yeah.
Other than TechCrunch,
and right. You know, for the average user like me or whoever, you're not going to know
which one's which.
You're just going to pay it and get it, and it's the same blog. It's just sort of repurposed for someone else to make money with.
Hayden, are you going to give that money back, or are you donating that to charity?
For the TechCrunch?
Yeah.
I've made so much off of Arrington. It's not funny. I bought this dog with some TechCrunch profits that I made, so. I don't know. I think I'm going to keep on to it for a while.
Well, an interesting thing, some other things in the article that were, you know, it's not just blogs that's the issue. Mm-hmm. You know, people could do this with books. People could do this with other content that necessarily isn't their own.
Right.
So it's this whole thing of, I guess, you know, they weren't really prepared to launch this properly. They didn't think it through.
Right. Well, and I think this is, again, this is the reason that you see different companies taking a little bit of a careful approach. When you see Apple taking a careful approach to what ends up on the iPhone, some people would say too careful. Mm-hmm.
It's kind of ironic. I do want to say that, you know, the net is so well known for the availability to download and bootleg traditional media, and now finally new media is being bootlegged, and all of a sudden
the injustice of it all.
What happened?
That's really funny.
Yeah, that's a good turnabout.
We hit post irony on the internet far quicker than we ever thought we would.
Now, speaking of being possibly a little too careful, we have Apple and AT&T. The question is, are they playing favorites with the App Store? And part of this is really wrapped around the Sling Player Mobile. So what's happening here? Go ahead, David. Give us a little bit of a...
So essentially, the Sling Player app was only allowed to utilize Wi-Fi versus the 3G network, if I'm correct in reading this.
When it was originally spec'd, as far as I know, from what I've heard, is that it was designed to work over 3G and over Wi-Fi. Mm-hmm. But as they got closer to the surface, I think that somebody, you know, cooler minds at AT&T and Apple said, maybe that's not such a good idea. Because, of course, you know, what Sling Player is designed to do is use up as much bandwidth as it can get a hold of. And so, you know, having a lot of people... And the problem, I think, that they have is that that iPhone users are very prolific users of media. Mm-hmm. So if you give them something like this and they go out and actually start using it, they will use it a lot. It's a much better format to watch stuff on, I think, than a lot of other mobile devices.
Yeah.
So I think that part of their challenges is that they know that this would, you know, tighten up the network pretty quickly. I think that's the theory anyway. And so what they've done is they've limited it to Wi-Fi. So right now it can only be used on Wi-Fi. Tim, do you think this is the long-term direction?
I agree with what you're saying. I mean, you know, you look at the iPhone and you go, man, you could do video live broadcasting with this, but it would kill the network. I mean, right now with the 3G, it's already, you know, tough to get 3G. And with the older iPhones, you know, things are slow. So, yeah, if they open it up, I don't know.
Well, I think that it's bad enough when you have... It's bad enough when you have like Ustream and other people that are actually streaming to the iPhone. It's a whole other thing when you start having people just be able to stream to themselves.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's letting a big cat out of the bag. It's not like letting a little kitty house cat out That's going to be a
well, tiger. And I think that's one of the things that they took issue with in the article was the fact that, you know, there are other apps out there that utilize the 3G network in the same fashion. It just, they won't eat up the same amount of bandwidth.
Well, that's the issue.
Yeah. No.
You know, so they're designed and to be fair, it sounds like Slingbox actually was designed to, it sounded like the Slingbox was designed to fit underneath the limits that they thought were going to be there from AT&T and Apple, but still, it sounded like they were a little afraid of that kind of democratizing it that far. And so, you know, those are, I think the Amazon and the Apple stories are kind of the two sides of that coin of maybe letting being a little too loose and maybe being a little too tight.
Too tight. Yeah.
I think that most of us would, assume that pretty soon we're going to be able to stream stuff to our website. I mean, stream stuff to our iPhone, whether it's us or, I mean, we're going to expect to see a lot of that.
Well, it'll be that WiMAX, right?
When
the WiMAX happens, then we'll all be safe, right?
What I can't wait for is is to be able to see the IMAX over WiMAX, because they're just going to put their, you know, once they give go. Us, we once the, now that the branding has already gotten to smaller screens, I just think that they should have an IMAX version that's just designed for WiMAX.
The IMAX app.
Yeah, the
IMAX iPhone.
Mini. And it's just on the iPhone, but you have to have really, really, really good headphones.
That's awesome.
So that should be interesting. Now, here, this is an interesting story coming up here. Bailing out the RIA. Yeah, is there enough? Is this really going to happen?
Jesus.
So what's the story here?
So essentially, it's another one of those things where the recording industry, you know, is kind of saying, "Hey, it's been unfair that radio stations have been promoting music for all these years," and so there's this new copyright office bill that's going through that is going to charge a lot more apparently to radio stations for playing the music.
Right.
Which, and so, the music's so good right now that it's really worth paying for, isn't it?
And the best part about the whole thing is that the radio stations are, they're doing so well.
You know, it's going to take off. This is going to be so widely accepted and adopted. I mean, people are just going to love this. Radio stations are going to flourish. It'll be the best thing for the radio industry since television.
That's great.
And when is the bailouts going to stop? I mean, how widespread are bailouts going to be that we'll be expecting them from our neighbors soon?
I was actually
everyone is getting a bailout.
I'm thinking of applying for a bailout. I'm not sure exactly what the bailout is for yet, but it doesn't apparently. That's not really the requirement. So to be technical about this is not a bailout from the government. This is what they want is they want to get a higher revenue. You know, and. Now, the thing to be clear of is they're already getting paid. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if they're a member of either BMI or ASCAP, I used to work at a radio station, we would get the bill, and it was oftentimes a very big bill and painful bill. So, you know, they keep track of everything, not everything. They take a sampling of the kind of stuff that you're playing, and then you pay, you know, against that, against the size of your market, the size of your station, the assumed cumes that you have. The radio stations are already paying for the music. What they want is to be paid more radio stations.
Didn't MTV go through this? I mean, I vaguely remember this happening to MTV where there was a crackdown. For a while, they could use music on any show. They had no problem. And then there was some kind of crackdown where they stopped playing as many music videos. They started doing shows. And on the shows, they played less music than before.
You know, I don't know what the story is behind it. Maybe that is one of the big reasons that we saw this huge changeover on MTV was, and I don't know the backstory of that, about whether that was the push that we said that MTV decided.
MTV crossed over to long-form programming because they couldn't prove to their advertisers that there was a specific block of time that people were watching, right. And that's what precipitated that move over.
Which is really too bad.
So but I think if the radio stations did something more reasonable, like, for example, they only charged extra for any songs written by 35-year-old men performed by 16-year-old girls, that should be – I think we should give them that.
You know, I actually paying more for that, I think that actually makes a lot of sense.
Because then we don't have to listen to Miley Cyrus anymore and Britney and that whole ilk.
That's
sorted.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that that would make a lot of sense. No, I think that, you know, it would help to figure out the business model and like, rather than trying to squeeze
more
out of it.
Before they can beg for money, yeah.
Well, it's that they're squeezing a very dry root right now. I mean, I think that's the issue is that there's not a lot of water left there anyway, and so they're just going to squeeze a little bit harder. And the, you know, I think in radio, we were always kind of indignant about the idea that we would have to pay anything, to be honest, for playing their songs because we were promoting their music. We would, I was a music director for an alternative rock station. And so I got every Monday and Tuesday, I spent the whole day on the phone with people trying to persuade me to play their bands. They weren't trying to persuade me to play the bands because they wanted money for that play. They were trying to sell, you know, CDs, but they're not doing a lot of that anymore. I think that's part of the problem. I think that one of the larger issues, and I mean, here's the question to you, is do we think that people are listening to less radio because, not because they pirated the music, but because they have so much on their iPod already?
Well, I think it's a combination of
the choice is huge.
Right.
The choice is huge of what we can listen to and watch at any given moment. And the pool is getting bigger and bigger, which means a lot radio stations, satellite radio stations, they're finding their chunk of the market shrinking on a daily basis. And there is no answer right now. And I think asking for money in this recession is, well, no one's going to take anyone seriously.
My question is the this is just me noticing how I have interacted with a lot of this stuff. And I, you know, on my iPhone, well, I have an iPod, the old classic 160 gig iPod that has every song that I own on it. And so what I'm left with oftentimes on a road trip is, will I randomly hope that a radio station sends me, you know, gives me a song I want to listen to, or will I listen to a playlist that I already have, you know, and know that every song is going to be the song that I want to sing to or listen to or whatever. That's the challenge is that as people have saturated their iPods, the question is are they ever really going to come back to radio?
And I think they're also finding other ways to discover new music, you know, Pandora, other things like that. You know, there's a lot more media available to them via the internet than was, you know, even a few years ago.
Tim, what do you think?
You know, it's what we want when we want it, and what's the easiest way you're going to get that?
Right.
I think until, you know, cell phones are killing the radio business in the car, and that used to be the last, you know, the last place that people listen to radio.
Right.
I mean, when you can stream your songs all across your house using your Wi-Fi network, why bother with radio? You can listen to exactly what you want. Even if you want to hear the sound of somebody typing on their keyboard while they're Skyping, you could probably get that and listen to that in your house.
Yes. I mean, I think that one of the things I noticed when even when you look at an older population, my dad, I showed him how to use his, you know, I bought him an iPod, like the little one, and showed him how to use iTunes, and I really realized within a week, I realized he's probably not listening to the classic radio station he used to listen to that plays the 60s and 70s or whatever that he used to like, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s that he used to like to listen to, because he now he just goes up to iTunes. Every time he gets up to iTunes, he was telling me he spends another $20 or $30, buys another bunch of songs that are old songs that he forgot that he even knew, and just is filling up his iPod with all of this stuff. But he has less and less reason to go back to listening to the radio, regardless of how expensive it is.
In an unrelated story, just about parents on the internet, about 2-3 days ago, I get this phone call from my mother saying, "How do we get on Twitter?" And I said, "I'm busy. Now's not the time." And the next thing you know, my father has somehow managed to like create their own Twitter account. But why do these, you know, late 60 somethings want to go on Twitter? Because my mother, my Jewish mother, bless her, wanted to send a Twitter to Patrick Swayze to tell him what vitamins he should be taking to help his cancer. I think that's it's a whole new world we're living in right now when our parents get on this thing.
No, when you know it's scary is when your mother is complaining that your wife is not on Facebook, so because she can't send a video to her. You know, I'm trying to send a video to your wife of your little niece dancing, you know, at this competition, but she doesn't have a Facebook account, so I can't send it to her. And I was like, wow, that's a brave new world. That's all.
I love the fact that Jewish mothers can now bother any celebrity at any time of the day with their advice. That's fantastic. Web 2.0.
That's great.
So another. Oh, this is the.
Well, were you gonna say one more thing? I was going to say probably to roll right into the next story would be like the Danger Mouse article. Did you guys see that? So basically, Danger Mouse, the whole thing is their next album, because of legal battles with the label, is not going to be released. So what they're doing is basically sending out this. It's an interesting thing to see, to watch unfold, but they're sending out this homemade picture book of art inspired by them, along with a blank CDR with all of the torrent files that you need to get their music.
That's what I call, bringing it back to the people.
Yeah.
So that's at a whole different level. I mean,
it's a different kind of podcast, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is he charging for that?
It says here that they're going to be sold. They're selling it, so it's a 100-page plus booklet of Danger Mouse inspired art, and then a CDR with all the links to all the torrents.
So the headline is, we're giving it away for free, and it only costs you $100. Nice one.
No,
not $100.
No, it's a 100-page book. 100-page.
Oh, and they're giving all of it away for free.
It doesn't say what they're charging. It says they're going to be selling it, but it doesn't say what they're charging.
Oh, sorry. So they are selling something. Yeah.
They're trying to sell something. So their fans can have some reason or some ability to give them some money. So they could, if their fans could do that, that might be the, that would be the issue.
Yeah, so basically it says, they'll be sold as a 100-page book of photographs inspired by the music and taken by David Lynch, and it'll include a blank CDR to be filled with torrented MP3s. All copies will be clearly labeled. That's what it says.
There you go.
Yeah.
Now, is there something with NPR on that as well? Does NPR have something to do with it?
I don't think so.
Or are they just talking about it?
I think they're probably just talking about it.
I don't think
NPR would get too close to...
Danger Mouse.
Well, not only Danger Mouse, but I don't know if they get too close to torrents, other than finding them interesting and reporting about them from the, from the outside. So, but yeah, I think the other thing that we've talked about before on this show is that the real money at this point for bands has really gotten into the situation where it's really about going, concerts,
live performance.
I mean, the Police have made more in the last, I think it was the last year or the last 2 years, than they made sell for all the sales of all the albums ever. I mean, those are the kind of numbers when it comes to performance. Now, what they figured out was they no longer sell tickets for $15 each.
Yeah, they sell them for 65 and
or 150 100 or 1200, and that's by doing that, you start wondering when these bands are going to just start distributing their music for free, because they make so little from the record companies. Or letting it go, putting out a lot of the music for free, because really where their money is, especially if you have a band that has a history of making money with performance, does it really make sense? Or you just want to get the music out as widely as possible. Tim, what do you think?
Well, David Meerman Scott talks a lot about this with the Dead, the Grateful Dead. And how they've, always allowed people to come to the concerts, record the music, and they made their money with the concert sales. So if you look at the history of entertainment, there's always been a turnstile for entertainment up until recently, where the turnstile is still there, but the wall is gone, and you can see past the turnstile, so you don't need to pay to go through the turnstile. And so now we're looking at how do we put that genie back in the bottle. And for a lot of people, it's the live events. I also think that the iPhone app is going to be a way that the genie goes back in the bottle.
Well, how what do you mean by that?
Well, with torrents, people are getting music for free. But if the music's only available on an iPhone app, and you can only listen to it at an iPhone app when you are watching a music video, then you're going to have to pay for it until somebody figures out how to crack iPhone applications. And the same thing for video. I think if you're paying for an iPhone app and you're getting the video at the iPhone app, that may, soon iPhone apps may migrate back to the computer, and you'll pay for iPhone apps on your computer as well as the iPhone and the iPod.
So it's kind of the idea is a closed media system.
Well, there's got to be some way for us to pay for high quality entertainment, or else it's not going to exist.
No, I'm not arguing with you. I'm just making sure that we're all clear. I mean, I think from a music perspective, you know, I think that we are really looking at a situation where a lot of these bands would do just as well and are doing just as well right now, just with the concerts, you know, and whether the music, whether, you know, it makes that much sense for them to, you know, be trying to fight this battle that is kind of hard to fight. Now, when it comes to video, that's another, you know, that's a whole other process. You know, I think that there are some, for instance, software companies that spend an enormous amount working on making sure that they are not pirated. Now, I used to have a 3D piece of software called Electric Image a long time ago, and they had the best encryption in the business. I mean, it was as good as it got, and there was no way to really crack it. There was a way to work around it for a little while, but outside of that, it was just almost impossible to crack. Yeah, they're in business, but they're, you know, we don't hear about them very often because on the other side of that, and I'm only bringing my 3D experience in because I think that it makes sense a little bit to this degree, which is that when you go back to the most pirated software when it comes to 3D is Maya and 3D Studio. They're also the highest penetration of 3D that's paid for in the industry at the same time. So what you have is, you know, I think that a lot of times we think about how are we going to close all these doors, and I'm not necessarily sure that closing all those doors is going to improve the market. I think that piracy is a very important, you know, piece of this. You know, I think that it's part of what makes sure that people actually know how to use it. I mean, I think that part of the reason that Photoshop has such a large control over the market was that, especially in the early days, I mean, everybody and their brother had a pirated copy of Photoshop. You know, it got to a point where, you know, that's how you had a whole section of training in Borders. Now that they've closed it down a little bit, they can do that because they have 95% of the market, but it creates huge opportunities for other people that are, you know, making that software now. I think that I'm not entirely sure that tightening it all up, you know, oftentimes just finding enough people that are willing to legally buy it is, you know, we build our business model. We make software and we make media as well, you know, training media. And, we actually, we build our business model around how many people will legally buy it, knowing that it won't be all of them. While we don't necessarily release it for free and you know, encourage people to pirate our software, it's a bit of a bummer, but we know that there's enough large companies and there's enough people who are straight up, and we don't charge very much for our software. And what we find is that the people who buy from us are people who are, you know, they have reputable companies and they don't want to be, you know, if you have a company that where you have a lot to lose, if you get caught with, you know, this kind of software, you tend to buy it. So, anyway, so I think we have one more story.
Yeah, actually, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Wolfram Alpha hype.
It was supposed to go up this weekend, and then it broke.
Yeah. I don't know if any of you guys have read much about this, but it's, you know, being called the Google killer, or the you know, the thing that's going to change the internet forever. And essentially what it is, it's a mathematical-based search system that utilizes a pretty good core background of technology to serve up, you know, real answers to questions, you know, versus this getting a whole list of stuff like when you Google something that may or may not be relevant to what you're looking for.
Right.
This is very focused, very specific, and answers your questions directly and supposedly gives you the information quicker, faster, smarter, all of that. What are the thoughts? Too much hype? Is it going to even do anything?
Well, this is the beginning of trying to apply. I tried one. I said, how do I get green screen? Thinking that I could just ask a question. And Wolfram Alpha isn't sure what to do with your input.
Yeah, that I was playing with it yesterday, and you know, there was a lot of stuff in there that it doesn't know what to do with my input. Like, I type my own name in. You know, it needs to be a combination of what Google can provide and what they can do if it's ever going to compete on a broad range with search.
Right. You know, I think that it's, you know, it could possibly be something that is a Google killer 10 years from now. But you know, now we have to remember to keep ourselves in check. We also have to remember that when Google came out, I know when Google came out, my first thought was, why are they bothering? Right. Why are they putting out this simple site, iYahoo everything?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just go to Yahoo and I search every time I need to find something. I just go to Yahoo. You know, that was my reality, and I just thought Google was the craziest business idea I had ever seen. It was a stupid little page with just the search. And now, you know, I go to my I go into my house and my wife is on Yahoo, and I look at it and I go, oh, isn't that so cute?
It's quaint.
Yeah, but I don't think it's I don't think that it's supposed to be. It's not supposed to be a Google killer, I think. At least that's what Wolfram Alpha is claiming. This is really a matter of...
Well, I want to say one thing here. I've now been to the Wolfram Alpha site, and I've written in, how can I lose weight? And it responds, they're not sure what to do with my input. And it's really simple, stop eating. And that's not on there. So I don't know if there's much success for Wolfram Alpha. Just saying.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's to your point. It's not meant to supplant, you know, what Google does. I think it's a different sort of thing when you're looking for certain types of searches for very specific answers. But I'm still just going to go to Google unless I can do everything in one place.
Now I do have to admit that there is some. I tried instead of green screen. I tried greens.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to admit that the response was fairly interesting. So with greens, its storage lifetime is 1.7 weeks for turnips, leafy, or collard. melting point of greens is 31.7 degrees Celsius, which I am very interested to try. The optimal storage is 0 degrees Celsius. You know, the optimal humidity is 97.5%. So anyway, I
so if listeners haven't switched over to Wolfram Alpha by now, they never will, because it couldn't get more interesting than that.
Well, as I said, this is the beginning. This is how they get started. And a lot of this is trying to figure out the, you know, this is taking into some of the stuff of the new kind of science, which is, which, you know, is the idea of using simple equations to, you know, find the solution rather than simple morphine equations rather than, you know, complex equations. And the issue with that is that approach is more scalable over time, but it's not necessarily scalable just yet.
There's some fun Easter eggs in it if you've played with it all. You put in, like, you know, how many roads must a man walk down? It gives you the answer, my friend is blowing in the wind. So it's got some fun little Easter eggs in there if you know what to put in.
I think definitely if you're interested in science and math, I think that there's a lot of opportunities. I'm not sure what we'll use it for in media yet. So, but it's something that it's worth us continuing to pay attention to. Any other big stories that we're missing?
Did you guys talk about Twittering from outer space last week?
We did not.
The first Twitter happened from outer space when the space shuttle went up last week.
Didn't it say something like launch is awesome?
That was pretty disturbing. Launch is awesome. I thought it said help, which really was disturbing.
No, I think that was actually, that made Saturday Night Live. I think they said, you know, if we're Twittering, it used to be one step for man, another, you know, and now it's launch was awesome. And
launch was awesome.
Dude,
aliens.
I'm drinking me some Tang.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, any other big stories that we've missed? I think
AT&T's thinking about offering cloud-based storage. So there's going to be another, if they do it, there'll be another Amazon type cloud storage place. And I wonder if that's going to be like the new thing. Everybody's going to be doing it.
Well, I think that this is probably not, once again, necessarily inside of This Week in Media, but I do think that you know, cloud computing and cloud storage, you know, getting it out of our individual computers is kind of a given.
I mean, we got to back it up someplace, right? And you can't always trust a hard drive.
Well, and it's not just, yeah, and it's.
But what's safe? At the end of the day, we're still putting media somewhere hoping it's not going to, you know, go tits up. So whether it's a cloud, a hard drive, or up somebody's backside, there's still chance it's going to be lost.
I think, yeah, exactly. Don't be too attached to it. I think that's the end result here. No, I think that the thing, though, is that and this does have to do with media professionals here, is that we are we have to deal with a lot of media. And one of the things is we're trying to get into a system where we're basically locally backing stuff up and backing up the most important things that we have to the cloud at the same time. So the idea is that it's a mixture of both. It just gives us another place. If the place burns down or we're robbed blind physically, not on the internet, that we would have somewhere where that data lives. You know, I think that's kind of the issue. And that's just storage. Yeah. Of course, a lot of this is cloud computing. So when you look at cloud services, when you look at like an Amazon S3, you know, service, it's not just storage. What we're talking about is the ability to run applications, the ability to run things on it that allow us to not have to worry anymore about the servers. This is exactly the issue that we're dealing with Squarespace, our sponsor, mm-hmm. is that I don't want to know where the server is. I don't want to upload to my WordPress to anywhere. I don't want to figure out where Drupal exists. I just want the thing to work. You know, and I don't want to worry about whether I'm on a 10 meg pipe or an 8 meg pipe or a OC3 or whatever it is. I don't want to think about that. I want that to be handled by somebody else. And I think that's where we're going with cloud compute, cloud storage, you know, all those things, is being able to have it somewhere else that I can access anywhere that I don't have to think about it.
Well, that's very fear based.
Whoa.
Sorry.
Go ahead,
with OpenID. Apparently, Facebook is embracing OpenID as well. So if you can store it wherever using OpenID, then for the media professional, it gets really easy.
Right. Yeah.
And I was just going to say, this whole thing sounds kind of fear-based. We actually lost all the Goodnight Burbank software a year or so ago, and we had to rebuild every single show. And that had been backed up on two drives, and both drives went belly up. I've since been told that if it's not on three drives, it's not safe. It doesn't exist. And that's what we're doing now. But the idea that, you know, you're talking about being robbed blind, nobody's going to come into your house, go straight for your hard drives and sell them for drug money. And then the idea that it's down to fire or earthquake or whatever. And it doesn't really happen that often. We're all still in our homes, the grand majority of us. So I certainly do believe in at least three backups of any files if they're important, whether they're on a cloud, in a hard drive, wherever. But I don't think that the selling point should necessarily be they're not in your house, so they're safe. I don't, you know.
Well, I think that I would say that it's just an additional, you know, additional backup. You know, the system that I've kind of been building in my house and office have been a Drobo, which would allow any one of the drives to fail. At the house, another Drobo that mirrors to it at the office, which is about 45 miles away, and then putting the most important things of those, backing parts of that up to the cloud as well. So what you end up with is kind of between three different places. It would be if I lost all three points of those of the way that that's structured, I would not be worried about my data anymore, because it would be a nuclear fallout. By my estimation. So I this is only the stuff that I consider the most important, you know, because data management is just become this for us. You know, we add 6 terabytes a week to our system, and so for us, we, you know, data management is everything, you know, and trying to figure out, you know, where all this stuff's going to go, and then also making hard decisions. So every week, also about 2 or 3 terabytes goes back into the system, because we decide that it's old enough that we're not going to come back to it, and we move on.
All I want is instant, fast access to my data anywhere.
Well, and that's the other reason to put it on the cloud, is that I don't have to think about it. I mean, I have.
It's not fast enough yet, though, is it?
It depends on how fast your connection is.
But isn't there more security issues when something's up on a cloud and not in a hard drive in your house? I mean, it's more convenient, but isn't it more dangerous?
I think that I worry about that to some degree, except for the fact that with a lot of these companies, their survival is based on security, and oftentimes they're far more secure than anything we're going to have in the office. You know, they have to deal with this. When you look at a company like Salesforce.com, mm-hmm. Is a good example. We do some work with them, and they have financial services running on it. I mean,
I'm reading that people are hacking into the Pentagon. So if the Pentagon isn't safe, I'm not putting my money on anyone that's going to be safe. I just don't believe that exists.
No, and I don't know. I don't have a lot of data that I think. I don't put my financials up there. So, you know, most of the data that I'm worried about is media. It's pictures of my kids. It's mm-hmm. or it's from the company's point of view. Our end products, you know, get backed up there. If someone broke in and stole episode 134 of MacBreak, you know, I'd probably
you'd be heartbroken. You'd cry.
I know.
But you could move on.
Believe you did that
but
to
me. As long as it was on one of those software sites that doesn't give you any attention, you'd be fine.
Exactly. So I think everyone out there is going to be looking around, making sure that we're properly propagated. So I think that the issue is that the everywhere, you know, for me, a lot of times, like, for instance, my presentations are all up on my .Mac account. Mm-hmm. So I have about eight to 10 presentations that I change for every seminar, but there's a version of them that has been done before that sits up on the net specifically because I've had my computer go down. I've lost my thumb drive. So I have it on my computer. I have it on a thumb. I have a 32 gig thumb drive that has every presentation that I have on it, so that I can plug it into any machine and just start going. But I also have it sitting on the .Mac account with every back, like behind the scenes image that I've ever taken, with all of the, you know, stuff that I need, so that if I need to rebuild one, if I need to just use the last one because something isn't working, and I'm just going to survive what I, you know, NAB or Macworld or whatever. And I've had those issues where, you know, something went bad, I lost what I thought I was going to be shooting, and that's where I'm really glad that I have stuff in the cloud. So it's I do think that anywhere, I don't think it's there yet, but I do have to admit it changes a lot. I think that there's this threshold we're about to reach with bandwidth that a lot of this changes dramatically when we're talking about having a 100 megabit connection or a 50 megabit connection. I only have at home, I have a 30 meg connection at home. It's promised to be 16, but it actually ends up to be 30. It was 30 this morning. It took me longer to download the 1 gigabyte. It was a 1 gigabyte upgrade for Xcode. I'm writing some software right now, and I realized I had the old version, and so I downloaded the upgrade for Xcode. It took me longer to install it once it was downloaded than it took to download it, you know, off my system. And when we get to that point with a lot of these things, you know, I think that our use of cloud. So I think what we're seeing is a lot of people preparing for the fact that they know a lot of people are going to have 10, 20, 50 megabits up and down, and at that point, for the average user, maybe not for us, but for the average user, being able to throw up a gigabyte in 15 minutes or half an hour is enough to keep everything that they own backed up. I mean, I had to back up my wife's computer, and there was she was asking, I don't know how it's going to fit to move from one computer to the other, and it fit. It was less than a gig. She'd had it for like 2 years, and there was less than a gigabyte of new data that needed to be moved over. And so I think when we are in a different, as media developers, we're in a completely different environment where we go through a lot of data. But I think for the average person, a lot of these cloud things make a lot of sense.
Well, I still think we should all be very concerned with all these media clouds cropping up around the world. Will this contribute to global warming?
You know, I was, you know, that was just as you were saying it started to pop into my head. You know, I think I think sooner or later we're gonna see a presentation from Al Gore talking about the dangers of cloud computing and how
too many clouds. Yeah,
it could be actually contributing. The reality is, by the way, before we say that, the reality is that the use of electricity to power the clouds might actually be contributing to global warming. So all those clouds actually may turn out to be a real problem. So anyway, anything else? I think we've run to the end. Tim, where can people find you?
They can find me at onetimstreet.com.
Excellent. And David, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter, David Rewalt, as well as my martial arts website, battletraining.com, or hiredavidnow.com.
And that one is the best one.
That
right
is
now.
The best one.
Yeah, but you're hired now. You're off a secret mission.
I'm off on a secret mission for a couple of months, yes.
Excellent. Hayden, where can people find you?
Well, nothing as good as Hire David. At Goodnight Burbank.
Nice marketing there.
Spelled that way. You know, every once in a while I came up with a good idea and it wasn't even mine. I'm also at Hayden Black. My production company website is evilglobalcorp.com. And we're about to launch a brand new series on Daily Motion later this year called The Cabanauts. So we can hook up thecabanauts.com, goodnightburbank.com, abigailsteendiary.com. It's all linked from Evil Global.
Great. Thanks, Aidan.
Thank you.
This is Alex Lindsay, and this mess that you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out.